Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Because of our traditions, we've kept our balance for many, many years. Here in Anatevka, we have traditions for everything. How to eat, how to sleep, how to work, how to wear clothes. For instance, we always keep our heads covered and always wear a little prayer shawl. This shows our constant devotion to God. You may ask, how did this tradition start? I'll tell you. I don't know, but it's a tradition. Because of our traditions, everyone knows who he is and what God expects him to do.
Anthony Warlower, the cast of Fiddler on the Roof, and the musical group Lorcastino getting us started today on Route 51. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today we're going to talk about tradition and change with our guest, Rabbi Dan Danson, who's been the spiritual leader of Wausau's Mount Sinai Jewish congregation for nearly 30 years, and who will soon be leaving, all too soon, from that position and also leaving the community. Rabbi Danson has served Mount Sinai for longer than any of its previous rabbis. He's been named one of the 28 most inspiring rabbis in America by the Daily Forward, a popular Jewish newspaper. His congregation marked its 100th anniversary in 2014, and it is now the only synagogue in all of North Central Wisconsin. As I said, today on Route 51, we're going to look at tradition and change, the history of the Jewish people in our part of Wisconsin, the way they've adapted to new circumstances through the years, and we'll look at what's happening in present-day America, the good things and the bad, including an increase in hate crimes and bigotry that many had hoped we were past. We'd also like to hear from you. If you've got a question or comment for Dan Danson, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. Dan, tradition plays a big role in the Jewish community.
It certainly does. It's certainly a big part of why people belong to Mount Sinai congregation and why it's so important to them.
And a lot of people in North Central Wisconsin, not only in your own congregation, but throughout the region, are going to miss you.
Well, I appreciate that, Glenn. It's very kind.
So why are you stepping down, and where are you headed?
So changes in our family setup. My wife will be taking a different position on the East Coast in southern New Jersey. We'll probably be living in Philadelphia. So it's poignant. I mean, it's been extraordinarily wonderful being the rabbi of Mount Sinai and being part of life here in North Central Wisconsin.
Is this a retirement for you, or are you going to be involved in a congregation in some official way in Philadelphia?
I think the term is reinventing oneself. So I'm not stepping into congregational role in Philadelphia. I may do some retraining. I'm thinking of either hospice or hospital chaplaincy. I'm playing with ideas. So I'll go there and look for some programs and see where I land.
When you took the position at Mount Sinai back in 1988, did you think that you'd be there for 30 years?
We were coming for 5 years and out. And here we are, 29 years later.
And are you happy with what you and the congregation have accomplished in that time?
I think, you know, of course, this is, yes, I think it's been a wonderful run. I think, you know, I always want to emphasize that that it's really a team. Good congregations are a team. And it's creating chemistry between the clergy and the congregation, and especially trying to animate the potential in the community.
Well, one thing that you certainly accomplished is longevity. You've been there as rabbi longer than anyone else.
Sure.
What do you think accounts for the fact that all of your predecessors, by and large, came to Wausau and then left soon after? Why have you been the exception?
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of things that changed, not the least of which is two careers. That's a huge change. So I'm married. I arrive as part of a couple. My wife is a physician in the community, loves the work she did in various medical organizations in the area. That anchors you. That's a change. If you have two careers that are working, that helps a lot. I think the other thing is that there's less of a focus on in congregational life, at least in the synagogue world, on quote climbing the ladder. I think a lot of us, I point to my colleagues in Rockford and Kenosha, Champaign, small places where colleagues have stayed for 15, 30, 35 years because you really have a chance to, it's intimate. Your relationships are profound and substantial.
You have a chance to make more of a difference, too, the longer you stay in one place.
Absolutely.
When you came to Wausau, when the leaders of the congregation sought you out back in 1988, you were in New York City when they interviewed you. Was it a tough sell?
No, not as tough as you'd want. To some degree, the anomaly was being in New York City. I grew up, I spent my summers in the Lake Country of Ontario. I'm from Ottawa, Ontario, which is just
You're Canadian.
I'm Canadian. Well, I am. I'm also American now. But I grew up in a cold place with snow and lakes and beautiful forests. So it wasn't that big a stretch.
Do those lakes and forests in north central Wisconsin, is there something about that that you find reaffirming to your soul, to your own spiritual advancement?
Yeah, it's a bit of a cliche that you find God in nature, but if you look at where Moses begins, it's out in the wilderness. I'm on faculty at our synagogue's regional summer camp. I'm in the camping unit. I still love pitching a tent and being in the outdoors, and being with youth in the outdoors is that unlocks spiritual things in everyone.
Well, North Central Wisconsin is a good place for that.
Absolutely.
When you were growing up, what motivated you to become a rabbi, to pursue a spiritual path?
My parents were co-founders of a synagogue in Ottawa. Which is, you know, when you found the congregation, it's a very intense, intimate, exciting experience.
Was your father a rabbi?
No, not at all. But he was, from a rabbi's perspective, he was more important than a rabbi and my mother. They were more important than a rabbi. They were lay leaders who really built and sustained a community.
Now, Mount Sinai is a Reform Judaism congregation as opposed to Orthodox Judaism and Conservative Judaism.
Correct.
Most of the folks who are listening right now are not Jews. So can you kind of give us a Cliff Notes version, explain the differences between those traditions and what it means that Mount Sinai is a Reform congregation?
Sure. So Reform Judaism. So curiously, it's the modernist wing of American Judaism. It's the part of Judaism that tries to work hard on accommodating the traditional values and inspiration, spirit of Judaism with being wholly integrated in the modern world, taking the best of both. Curiously, it's the oldest branch of American Judaism.
Really?
Yes. It begins modernist, and it actually, the Orthodox resurgence in America is only about 50, 60 years old. So that's a whole story in itself. Mount Sinai being a Reformed congregation, we've been a variety of different things. There used to be two congregations in town. Mount Sinai is the oldest. It was Reformed, but then in 1917, Beth Israel was founded, which was essentially an Orthodox congregation, and it was larger and more substantial for many years. But they informally merged in the 40s. Mount Sinai became a conservative congregation in the middle between those two, Orthodox and Reformed. And then in the late 60s, became a Reformed congregation.
Now, you've got a book out that details the history of Mount Sinai on its 100th anniversary, The Little Shul That Could. And
sure.
In there's a whole section on the history of Jews in north central Wisconsin.
Right.
And it gets into this dichotomy between Mount Sinai and Beth Israel. And this is all tied in to two different groups of Jews in north central Wisconsin at the time, the German Jewish tradition,
yep.
And then you had another group from Russia and Poland and Eastern Europe.
Right.
Talk about that.
Sure. So the article is by Gail Skelton, a member of ours who's a retired UWSP professor. So the first group of Jews who come to America are part of the German immigration, part of what brought lots of people to north central Wisconsin. They've already been living kind of in a Western acculturated setting for three generations, and they found Reform Judaism. That's their Judaism. It really is trying to have a kind of Western European modality to it. About 30 years later, in the 1870s and 80s, the Eastern European Jews come. They're coming from Poland and Russia. They are not assimilated at all. They live in very self-sustaining, isolated communities, and they're completely traditional. And their Judaism is conservative, orthodox.
So they're the ones that did Beth Israel.
They're Beth Israel.
And then we had Mount Sinai doing the Reform congregation.
Right.
And then eventually the two congregations merged.
Right.
Did you find of course you weren't here at the time, but did the leaders of this new congregation find that now they had to be all things to all people and they couldn't quite be the Reform congregation that they used to be?
Well, right. So you have, I mean, it's a great description of American Jewish life. So it's the children of the immigrants who are going to drive that merger. And they see themselves as stronger with one unit. And yes, conservative is the compromise between the traditionalists and the Reform branch.
So Mount Sinai became a conservative congregation for
about 20 years.
And what made it go back to being a Reform congregation?
Well, in a small, frankly, it was because they thought they would have more success attracting a rabbi, a better candidate, by being a Reform congregation. That was a very successful move for them, with all due respect to my conservative and Orthodox brethren. It gave them much more flexibility. It's one of the reasons why I think we've thrived, because Reform just has a lot more flexibility than conservative.
Now, the early Jews who moved into Wausau were business leaders. You had the Heinemanns.
Sure.
Benjamin and Nathan. Nathan was born in Baden, Germany. He arrived in Wausau in 1873, and he eventually became the president of the German-American Savings Bank. He founded the B. Heinemann Lumber Company. And then you have what started as a small dry goods store, led by Nathan, became the Beehive Store, which is the first business in the county, in Marathon County, to install electric lights back in the late 1800s.
Sure, sure.
And then there's still a plaque in downtown Wausau on the Heinemann Building on 3rd Street.
And up towards Gleason, north of Merrill, there was actually a town called Heinemann for a while. There was a lumber town. So you had families like the Heinemanns, who are very storied in the community, the Winkelmanns, who found the other department store downtown. But you should also know what happens is that, right, there's these businesses, but folks bring their cousins, their nephews, their nieces, brothers and sisters in. So the community is diverse. Some folks own businesses. Lots and lots of folks work for the businesses. It's a mixed community economically.
And many of them were in the retail business. He also had Joe Weisberg, who was the head of the Fair Store. Mm-hmm. So in 1918, you had the Heinemann Department Store, you had Winkelmann's, and you had Weisberg's Fair Store. The three major department stores in Wausau were all owned and operated by Jews.
And this is an American story. That to this day, when you look at groups who immigrate to America, they find an economic niche and off they go as a community. This is a story of small American cities all through the Midwest, all through the South. It's very typical of American towns through the late 50s, and then everything changes.
How did everything change in the late 50s?
Well, you know, what happens is you have much more corporate stores coming in. The other thing that happens is people send their kids away to college and to be professionals, and they don't come back. And so there's a decline in local retailing and wholesaling through the 70s and 80s. The kids who would have come back to run the businesses don't come back. And many Jewish communities in small cities decline at that point. But part of North Central Wisconsin's Jewish community story is we don't.
Now, Jews have always been a minority in North Central Wisconsin. I think it probably surprises a lot of people that they were movers and shakers in the Wausau area in Central Wisconsin from the very beginning. Nathan Heinemann was a member of the Wausau Club, which really determined economic policy back before the turn of the last century. Does it seem remarkable to you that as Jews in this backward frontier town of Wausau, even in the 1800s, they were accepted here and became business leaders?
You know, you can't. You can't overstate how much American Jews fell in love with America. I mean, fell in love with America. There's no other word for it. And also that America was so embracing of groups who were really set apart from each other in Europe. But in America, they really found common cause. It's an amazing story.
Peter, who's a member of your congregation, wrote on Facebook, he wants you to discuss the changes you've seen in the Jewish community since you've come here. He says, we used to be much more Wausau and now we're much more spread out. And he also notes that there used to be heads of households who were born and raised here, and now almost everyone who moved here as an adult.
Well, that kind of describes it. So right. So there's this shift in the late 70s and early 80s. There's another Beth Israel synagogue in Stevens Point.
And it's not around anymore.
It closes in 1985. Building's still there, part of the Portage County Historical Society. But, so there's some really visionary leadership here, both rabbinic leadership, Rabbi Larry Marr, Rabbi Jamie Gibson, and there's a lot of visionary lay leadership. They really embrace this idea of a true regional congregation. And it's really worked for us. It is what we are. We have members, you know. Our membership is exactly your listening area. That's our membership.
And you're the only synagogue in north central Wisconsin. The region has hundreds of churches, mm-hmm. but only one synagogue. I mean, essentially, as the rabbi here, the area you represent is about the size of the entire country of Israel.
Yes, or I like to say there's 10 states smaller than our congregational area, Maryland down. They're all smaller than us. Yeah, we serve a big area. But my colleagues on the East Coast would say there's no traffic, so it doesn't count.
And as the only rabbi in town in the area, that means essentially Dan Danson is the face of the Jewish community. Anytime the media needs a Jewish perspective on an anti-Semitic attack or something that's in the news affecting the Jewish community, mm-hmm. you're the guy they come to.
That has been the story, yes. I'm sure the media here will be delighted to get a fresh new face talking about Jewish issues. But yes, that's been the public role of the rabbi here is really one of the really enjoyable for me. I find it to be a great challenge and a real interest, and it goes beyond the media. It goes to speaking on forums and at colleges and to church and congregational groups. It's really an exciting part of what I do.
You write in The Little Shul That Could, 100 Years of Mount Sinai, you write that you consider the congregation to be the Jewish embassy in the North Woods. What do you mean by that?
Well, right. So you can live in parts of America where you bump into Jews all the time. If you live in Chicago, if you live in Philadelphia, live in Los Angeles, you're going to be, if you're out in the community, you're meeting Jews all the time. But here, you can live your whole life in north central Wisconsin and almost never have met somebody who's Jewish. So we're often going to working with folks who want to get to know the Jewish community, want to hear about what Judaism's about. So we're really, people are reaching out to us to learn about Judaism, and we're very much reaching back.
Do you find that members of Christian churches will come to your services in order to get more of a feeling for their own tradition, since Jesus was a Jew, to see, you know, where a lot of his influences came from?
Sure. So it's ebbed and flowed through the years, but I sometimes joke that I'm the expert on church confirmation students, because I probably see more of them in a year than anybody else does with the groups who come to the, especially confirmation classes. Pastors are very good about bringing their kids to learn exactly about Christian background, about Jewish heritage. And interestingly enough, especially from the small towns, from Dorchester and from Eagle River and from Shawano and from mm-hmm. Neillsville, we really see confirmation classes from those places.
And you've reached out to other religious leaders in other congregations. Part of that is because you're always asked to be on these interfaith mm-hmm. panels.
Sure.
But you've developed a very close relationship with a number of of Christian and Muslim leaders in the area.
Sure, sure. And one might joke that if you're part of a, if you're a leader in a minority community here, we often end up on panels together, so which is a lot of fun. We know each other well. We trust each other. We've shared in community presentations. That's kind of a neat experience.
Our guest today on Route 51 is Rabbi Dan Danson, who is stepping down after nearly 30 years as the leader of Wausau's Mount Sinai congregation. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. We've got a one call that's waiting, and I encourage you to continue to wait. We'll get to you after the next break. Here's Bob Dylan.
I pity the poor immigrant who wishes he would have stayed home, who uses all his power to do evil, but in the end is always left so alone.
Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where natural woodlands, bluffs, prairies, and river serve hundreds of students each year as field laboratories in disciplines from art to entomology. Support also comes from Attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
Itzhak Perlman with the theme to Schindler's List, getting us into the next segment of Route 51 with Rabbi Dan Danson, who's stepping down as the spiritual leader of Wausau's Mount Sinai congregation after nearly 30 years. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page and I'll read it live on the air. Dan, you're often asked to go to middle schools in the region to talk to the students there about the Holocaust. What are those presentations like?
Well, first of all, they're very moving because the initiative for Holocaust education has come from the faculty at the particular school. And it's really coming out of, I think, a sense that's permeated America about how important it is to teach about genocide.
How do the students react?
They're very curious. They're curious about... when I come, we're talking about Judaism. I mean, they're hearing about the details of the Holocaust from their teachers. So they're especially interested in just Jewish tradition, how it's practiced. They're very delightful. I mean, it's hard to overemphasize how curious they are about other traditions and other cultures.
We have a phone call on line two. Ray from Rhinelander, you're on with Dan Danson. Hello, Ray.
Hello. Hello, Dan. Hello, Rabbi. Thank you very much for everything you've done in this area. I was brought up around a variety of Jewish people, mainly around Milwaukee, Menominee Falls. We knew the Steins, the Siemens, and many others. My mother worked for them. Moving up later up to northern Wisconsin, Wausau was a wonderful experience for me when I was there. I want to honor someone who's passed on, Mr. Plattner, who had Wausau Steel. He had spent time in the camps, a very humble man, very courteous, very polite, a very stoic type of individual. I highly respected him. I just want to honor him on the radio, a very solemn, humble man. He was very, very, very informational. The Jewish traditions and a variety of different things around the area were interesting, especially Eagle River, the summer camps they have there. There's a lot of Jewish people that own land on the lakes and things. I worked at some of those camps. I worked with Boy Scout exchange groups from Israel. And so my experience with the Jewish people and variety of different communities has been very positive, very informational. I always really felt good about the courteous respect I was given, and vice versa. And so with that, you're more open with people. When you feel comfortable, they welcome you in. The information is exchanged. Barriers are let down. So I'm calling mainly to honor some people that I was brought up around that were Jewish, and also to say thank you and all of you in the area for everything you have brought into north central Wisconsin. I can't thank you enough.
Ray, thanks so much for the phone call. Dan Danson?
So let me spend a minute on Fred Plattner, who you made reference to. So Fred sadly passed away a few months before I got here in 1988, but he spoke extensively to schools about his experience in the Holocaust. He left Bequesta Synagogue, that was an elemental part of us building our new building, which was finished in 91. But I think Fred took to heart his experience to really do work on behalf of other people. He raised a lot of money every year for the Crop Walk. It's just interesting to see how people, you know, he's a great example of somebody who took a devastating experience and brought life to the community he became a part of, and really you know, preached a hugely important humanitarian lesson.
Dan, we've seen an uptick in the number of reported hate crimes this year and last directed at both Jews and Muslims. The Southern Poverty Law Center reported a burst of incidents following the election, a total of 1,094 in the first month following the November 8th election, with the incidents tapering down since then.
Okay. So everything, you know, there are a few things that aren't fraught in terms of public life in America right now. I mean, people are very much on edge. Always. So right, there's a real concern about what's the content of this, about is it a brief phenomenon, is it an escalating phenomenon? What I would say is that the public language we use towards each other, all groups in our society, all ethnicities and religions, is really critical in terms of how people conduct themselves publicly. And especially in promoting an atmosphere of mutual respect and dignity. And that's something we just always need to be on guard of. There's no question our public language has a huge public impact.
On Saturday of last weekend in downtown Chicago, a synagogue was vandalized. Right. The Chicago Loop Synagogue, it's been operating since 1929. Mm-hmm. The vandal broke a window and left swastikas behind. Mm-hmm. And then we've got these Jewish community centers across the country that have been targeted with bomb threats. The Harry and Rose Sampson Center in Whitefish Bay in the Milwaukee area was evacuated last Tuesday. And according to, I called the Jewish Community Center Association to get a handle on what was happening nationwide. And they told me that just in the last few weeks, there were 57 bomb threats received by centers in 26 states and one Canadian province. They came in three waves, one on January 9th, one on January 18th, and one on January 31st. Right. A lot of us thought we'd put all of this behind us. What's happening in America?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm sometimes too much of an optimist on these topics. That's certainly a discussion I have with people in the Jewish community. I'm going to go back to public language. When one of the huge things that happened in the 1950s and 60s was that there was an evolution in America that public language attacking other groups, minority groups, was really dampened down, and really, really there was a real public campaign to make that beyond the pale. And it had a huge impact. It had a huge impact on the Jewish community. Business, working doors, hospital doors, employment doors, social doors opened up to the Jewish community in the 50s in a way they had never done. And that was part of a change in the language people used. So I think, I think this is a time where people are some people are reading that there's permission to go ahead and reinstate language that attacks minority groups. That's why it's important for people to speak out and say that's beyond the pale, and that we've seen that historically. Hatred's always going to be present in a society. The question is, what's the larger reaction to it, and how do we keep it in check?
What responsibility do you think our leaders have to move people from hatred to acceptance, tolerance, and love for people of other religions? And I'm thinking specifically of the President of the United States.
So I'm going to move carefully here, Glenn, which is that there's people in my congregation who are hopeful about the president of the congregation and what he's doing for the country. There are lots of people who are wary. I mean, we have people on both sides. I say again and again, God is not a Republican. God is not a Democrat. I'm going to give the president the benefit of the doubt to say that he's certainly not setting out to promote hatred, but I hope as he's in the office that there's a learning curve that your words, a sentence thrown out quickly, can have a gigantic impact, and that our presidents historically have been very careful in the last 60, 80 years to use language that really promotes an inclusiveness in America. And I hope President Trump is part of that historic experience as he moves through the office.
Your reaction to the public outcry over the travel ban from those seven Muslim majority countries?
So HIAS, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which is has a storied history of settling immigrants in America, began with the Jewish community, then moved out from there. So HIAS put together a letter, an open letter, basically saying that taking in refugees is a storied American tradition. Also looking back to a time in the 30s where Jewish refugees weren't taken in, and the horrific result of that.
Mm-hmm.
So 1,500 rabbis, that's about half the rabbis in America, signed on to that letter. I signed on to that letter. I mean, a huge number of us signed on. So, look, the president absolutely has the prerogative to say these are policies I think that we need to do to protect our borders. But it needs to be done very carefully. I'm a former green card holder. The idea of coming home one day with my green card in hand and not being able to go back to my house, that's pretty strong stuff.
We do have a problem with Muslim religious extremists in some parts of the world and in America committing acts of terrorism. Israel has dealt with that for a long time. What's Israel's experience with this? How have they reacted?
Well, I mean, Israel's, again, a strongly political question. Israel's, had enormous success in damping down terrorism. It's done it through, again, when you're in Israel, the daily security measures are enormous in terms of bags being checked and checkpoints and so on and so forth. There are folks, clearly there are some issues on the Palestinian side on those issues, but I think one of the things that you'll see within the 48 borders of Israel is that there's been a strong move to use dynamic intelligence to still maintain an open society, and that's the challenge for us.
Well, the challenge is whether or not you pursue a two-state solution. John Kerry, the former Secretary of the State, said Israel has two choices. You can be a democracy or be a Jewish state. You can't do both. What's your reaction as a rabbi to that comment?
So I've publicly spoken in favor of a two-state solution for 29 years. There's a dynamic debate within the Jewish community, which on one side would say security first, And on the other side would say, but there's this proud tradition of human rights within the Jewish community. It's a very lively debate within the Jewish world. I think the concern from my side of the street is that Israel not expand settlements and preclude the possibility of a two-state settlement. The security argument is, with Hamas in Gaza, there's still real concerns about whether this is also a possibility to sign a peace treaty.
And we should also mention that President Trump has said that expansion of the settlements would not be a positive move. So there seems to be bipartisan support both from this administration and the previous administration in that regard.
Right, and you can make the argument that Israeli politics are complicated. I think that the majority of Israelis are still not in favor of expanding settlements, but for a variety of reasons, politically, that gets more support than the numbers would seem to indicate.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Jerry from Minocqua. Jerry, you're on Route 51 with Rabbi Dan Danson.
Thank you, Glenn. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Jerry. Good to hear from you.
You've done a good job of talking about the outreach of our congregation and how the impact that it's had locally and across the state. I'd like to talk a little bit about the internal workings of our distinguished rabbi. He has taught us in an extraordinary way how to be tolerant of a range of ritual practice, of a range of opinions, of a range of the way we want our congregation to be. He has helped us to deal with disagreements on all manner of things without letting those disagreements get out of hand. And he has been an extraordinary teacher of Judaism without imposing a way to practice, a way that we had to be a certain way, because he recognized early on that he was the leader of a congregation that took in people that practiced Judaism in a variety of ways. And as you probably know, Jews have an opinion about everything, and it's usually more than one opinion, and it's usually strongly held. And our rabbi has taught us to listen to each other and to behave accordingly with great courtesy despite our disagreements.
Jerry, thanks so much for the phone call. Dan Danson?
So thanks for the kind words, Jerry. So people talk about when you're in a congregation, a single congregation in a place, it's called, the Hebrew for it is a kol bo. Everything is in it. That you have to you've got people who if they're in a larger center, some of our members would be in conservatives, some would be in other branches, Reconstructionist Jewish Renewal. So we're always striving to accommodate without losing color. It's a great lesson in listening to each other. It's a great lesson in appreciating each other's perspectives. I think it enriches the Mount Sinai experience. I find it to be an exciting challenge rather than a daunting one.
Nancy on Facebook says, thank you, Rabbi Dan Danson, for serving the needs in our community. You are truly a person who meets people where they are at. Thank you for helping our understanding and healing everyone with dignity.
That's very kind.
Our guest today on Route 51 is Rabbi Dan Danson. He's stepping down after nearly 30 years as the leader of Wausau's Mount Sinai congregation. We're going to take a short break, and we have Barbara Streisand queued up right now on our virtual turntable, performing a traditional Jewish prayer, Avinu Melkeinu. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Very nice.
What's the background to this before we listen to it?
So Dan? Avinu Melkeinu is... it's our parent, our ruler, It's a petition we sing on our penitential days on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, our New Year's and Day of Atonement. And in it, we're asking God for mercy. And then we go down, we collectively list our sins.
Here's Barbara Streisand.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Harold A. and Helen D. Engel Fund, helping to keep educational information available to communities throughout the state by providing support for Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that your preacher is liable to teach you, it ain't necessarily so. Little David was small, but oh my. Little David was small, but oh my. He fought big Goliath, who lay low and dieth.
Paul Robeson singing the music of George and Ira Gershwin, taking us into our final segment of Route 51 with Rabbi Dan Danson. Dan, it ain't necessarily so. That's how the lyrics go, which is a reflection of the conflict between believers and non-believers, but also between those who take the scripture literally and those who view its words as metaphors for a greater truth. That's something that plays out in quite a few Christian congregations. Is the same dynamic playing out in Jewish congregations as well?
More between Jewish denominations than within congregations. The Jewish approach to text is the way I like to put it is interpretive. There's always been a rich tradition of commentary and imagination and interpretation of classic text. So there isn't, we might talk about Jewish branches that talk about the historical development, those that don't. The fault lines in Judaism tend to be on whether you do execute religious law literally or metaphorically.
Was the earth created in six literal days, like it says in Genesis? Did Noah really put two of all living creatures on the planet Earth in a single ark? Did Methuselah live to be over 900 years old?
Well, I'm deeply steeped in what's called a critical text tradition. At my seminary, Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, was about nothing if not about working off of the great 19th century German scholarship on the Bible as a historical document and multiple authors and different evolutions. So you may be asking the wrong guy to say those are literal things. Let me give you a quick example of how rabbinic text works. So we're talking about the Talmud, let's say, written in the year 500 AD. So take an example like in Exodus, where it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. So the rabbis look at that and they go, well, that may be the case, but no two eyes are the same quality. No two hands are the same skill. So if we lop one person's hand off for another person's, it's not an equivalent. So we're going to find a better method. Maybe we'll do civil fines. Maybe we'll figure out what the value of that hand that was lost was, and we'll do a civil lawsuit for that, and we'll do monetary damages. They never rescind the Exodus law, but they say there's a better way of executing it.
Leviticus contains many prohibitions against eating shellfish and pork.
Sure.
Also prohibitions against homosexual acts.
Sure, sure.
What is the modern Jewish perspective on those passages? And how about yours? How do you reconcile those passages with your own tolerance for and acceptance of gay and lesbian people?
So I'm part of the Union for Reform Judaism, Central Conference of American Rabbis. We've been leaders in terms of reaching out to make LGBT people, members of our congregation, be able to live their lives wholly, openly, and as full integrated members of the congregation, through a series of motions starting in the 70s, really coming to fruition in the 90s. So how do you interpret a passage like that? Well, again, there's passages on slavery in the Torah, there's in the Bible, there's all sorts of passages which we, like the one I just cited in Exodus, we interpret and we reinterpret. We elevate. You're always in the process of elevating one passage over another to welcome the stranger, that all people are created in the image of God. So in different times, we've elevated different passages, and today we see that as an injunction that was fixed in a particular historical time, that other elements and spirit of the text make us act differently.
So that was an historic prohibition, not necessarily one that applies in the year 2017.
That's how Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism would interpret it. It's even in the Orthodox world, there's some interesting discussions going on.
I want to squeeze in one more phone call. We have David from Wausau. David, you're going to have to be relatively brief, I'm afraid. We're running out of time.
Well, I'm Irish, Glenn, so I don't know if I can do that. But I'm going to go back to turning this into a love fest. Back in 77, I married Fred Pleitner's granddaughter, one of Fred Pleitner's granddaughters, so it was really nice to hear homage being paid to Fred earlier on the show. And then we left Wausau, but when we came back, Rabbi Dan was the new rabbi in town and at Mount Sinai, and I just want to say that he was a great and nurturing influence in our on our interfaith marriage and on my three children, and I want to thank him deeply for that. And if he wanted to talk about interfaith marriages, but if I were you, Dan, I'd leave it alone and just let me say that we all love you and we're going to miss you.
Thanks for the kind words.
All right, Dave, thanks so much for the phone call. We're just about out of time. You've been involved in a lot of social justice work.
Sure.
With the group Naomi, working against the restoring bus service.
Mm-hmm.
in Weston.
Yeah.
The Marshfield Cultural Fair is kind of a religious outreach that, mm-hmm. that happened after a anti-Semitic material was displayed at
sure.
the local
sure.
library.
Yeah.
Social justice is important for you.
It is. I you know, there's lots of people working on it in the community. Father Steve Bryce and the transit issues are a good example of that. But I think we're always, you know, it's a religious call for us to always be asking the question. The Torah, more than anything else, talks about, uses the metaphor of the stranger and the widow. There's always this metaphor of how are we reaching out to people in need? How are we making our society more just? It doesn't mean every public policy has to make us all cookie cutters, but it means we're always asking, how do we make our society open? How do we make it so the opportunities are there for everybody? How do we not leave people behind as we move on?
Dan, we are completely out of time. Thanks so much for being with us
today. It was
today.
A pleasure, Glenn. Thank you.
We want to thank today's guest, Rabbi Dan Danson of the Mount Sinai Congregation of Wausau. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jana Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by John Gross, the cast of Fiddler on the Roof, Lorca Stina, Bob Dylan, Itzhak Perlman, Barbara Streisand, Paul Robeson performing the music of George and Ira Gershwin, and Dick Dale and the Deltones. Next week on Route 51, our guest is U.S. Representative Ron Kime. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.